This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is The Rundown. So, the Electoral College. You probably only think about it for a few days every 4 years when it's time to vote for president.
So this might be tough, but if you can, in a few sentences, can you explain how the Electoral College works?
Okay, yes. It is going to be tough in a few sentences, but I'm going to do my best to distill it.
Thank you.
This is Professor Wilfred Codrington III. He's a constitutional law scholar at the Brooklyn Law School. His focus is on constitutional reform, election law, and voting rights. I asked him to come on the show because WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times have been getting into what makes our democracy tick as we lead up to this year's presidential election.
Every state gets a certain number of presidential electors who exist only for the purpose of choosing the president and the vice president. It is partly based on the population. It is also partly based on the default that everybody gets at least three. Basically, what you have to do to become the president is to win the majority of those. So that would be 270.
Basically, the Electoral College gives individual states the power to decide presidential elections. Some states have a lot of power, other states have very little, and as for the overall popular vote, well, that's pointless. Professor Codrington has written extensively about the origins of the Electoral College, as well as why it's problematic. Today, he's going to help us understand how we got here, as well as some of the political pieces that dictate whether or not the system should or can change.
So now I want to talk about why the framers of the Constitution created the system this way. And we're going to get into some of the racially motivated origins in a minute. But for right now, can you explain succinctly what are some of the reasons the framers gave for creating this system?
Yeah, so we're going to put aside the race.
Yes, just for now.
But I want to recognize that is very deeply entrenched in the system too.
Yes.
And that it's hard to kind of think about all the reasons without thinking about them as interlocking, right?
Okay.
So there were multiple reasons why they wanted what they wanted or why they didn't want what they didn't want.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really wanted the Electoral College. It was this sort of fluke where they landed on that because it was sort of not as disagreeable as the other alternatives. So it was just created and everybody's like, okay, this works. It's not hated as much as the alternatives. Now let's talk about the alternatives and why they didn't choose them. And I think that's kind of the important question. The alternative that we might think about most logically is the system that we know and love and see most used everywhere, which is direct vote by the people.
Most other countries, democratic.
Most other countries, systems. Every single state who elects their governor, you know, everywhere, right? Like,
yeah, got you. Even within our own country. Yeah.
This is an outlier. That is like the sort of what we should highlight is the Electoral College is an outlier internationally and domestically. And so when that idea came up, it was kind of just laughed off the stage. And this is because a few reasons, but I want to highlight something that people sort of gloss over. The framers just spoke disparagingly about the idea of democracy and disparagingly about the idea of the common person making these difficult decisions. In effect, they just didn't trust them, right? And the best thing for somebody in a position of privilege and power and wealth is the status quo, right? Like, and so if the people were going to vote against the status quo, that's what they did not want.
Yeah. So you also wrote an article for The Atlantic a few years ago called The Electoral College's Racist Origins. You argue in that article that, quote, race and slavery were perhaps the framers', quote, foremost considerations. Let's get into that. Tell me more.
Yeah. So the other big divide is the divide between the North and the South. You know, 95% of the slaves that we had were in the South. And so that's a big disparity. Basically, in designing the system of government, the South wanted to maintain as much power as they had. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they were obviously not trying to allow their slaves, which they considered, who they considered to be property, not people, to participate. So how do you protect this system? Well, the way that they kind of did this is through the Electoral College and, you know, the Three-Fifths Clause. And the Three-Fifths Clause basically says that 60% of any slaves that were owned would count towards the population of that state.
Right. So an enslaved person is 3/5 of a human, which is 60%.
Correct. And so that basically boosts your numbers, right? You're getting more political power by counting a fraction of the politically powerless. And so that's deeply problematic to start. But what that does is that boosts their numbers in terms of their population. And as I said, the Electoral College is in large part based on your population. And so the sort of long and the short of this is you get a state in the North, like Pennsylvania, who at the time had about 450,000 people. That is equivalent to approximately the free population of a state like Virginia in the South. But Virginia also had 300,000 slaves. And so when we think about how many electoral votes each should get, well, that you would think that they would start out equal, right? But because of Virginia's slave boost, they ended up with 6 more electors than Pennsylvania.
Wow.
So Pennsylvania ended up with 16 after the first census, and Virginia ended up with 21. And there are corollaries to that for every state in the South to the North, right? 4 of the first 5 presidents were slaveholding Virginians. Now,
wow.
Why? Right? It's because they were able to exert their influence based on being the largest slaveholding state.
Wow.
And I just want to like also just unpack that a little bit more to let you know the implications of that, because, you know, presidents do a lot, but presidents and among those things are presidents nominate justices to the Supreme Court. Mm. And so that's how we get a Supreme Court that is pro-slavery for the first, you know, 80 years of the country until we start getting to the Civil War. And so today, let's think about today, how it impacts Black people in particular, but racial minorities overall. The way that the Electoral College works, and it doesn't have to work this way, but this is the way that we do in 49 states in the District of Columbia. If you win one more vote in the popular election than your closest opponent, you win all of the electoral votes of that state, right? So it does not matter. We can think about that however we want, but one way to think about that is that if you have a large population of minorities concentrated in your state, but they're not 50%. So a place like, for example, North Carolina, where you're nearing 30%, or Alabama, where you're nearing 30%. Those votes, if they don't get to 50, they're just wasted. Right. Because it doesn't matter who they vote for, how they vote, because if they're outvoted, and they are outvoted by white people, conservative white people, then that's where the presidential votes are going. So and that's where, you know, at this point in time, we're like 60-65% of Black people are located in the South. Mm. They're concentrated in big numbers. And they are representing, you know, between 20, 30, 35% of the state populations. And it doesn't matter who they vote for. And we see some little turns in places like Atlanta, or Georgia stands out to me, right? Because in the recent election, we saw that it turned out differently, slightly, but differently, right? And we ended up getting a black senator. This is largely based on the votes of black people, clearly. So you do get some sort of exceptions where like things can happen one way or another, but those are, I want to emphasize, exceptions until demographics sort of shift. And so basically, I want to let you know how you can tell the South knew that this system is in their advantage. In 1969 and 1970, there was a very popular proposal to abolish the Electoral College. It was supported by 80% of the United States. It was passed Congress or the lower house overwhelmingly, so it got to the two-thirds you had to get to pass a constitutional amendment. And then it got to the Senate, and it was filibustered. And it was filibustered by Southern segregationists, including Strom Thurmond, who basically noted that under that system, the votes of those people who now are functionally meaningless would be meaningful. All right. And so they filibustered it and they killed the bill. So we were so close to not even having an electoral college, except for Southern segregationists realizing it was in their interest to maintain the system. So they filibustered it.
Can you tell me about, I want to just drive this point home so that I make sure I understand and the person listening understands. Say if North Carolina has 30% of their population is black folks. If there was no electoral college, tell me about what that would look like in that state. You told me what it looks
Yeah,
like if
so
there is an electoral college, those votes basically don't matter. But without that, what does it look like?
yeah, if we have a direct vote, and I think I'm gonna assume my numbers are correct, but I think North Carolina has about 11 million people, and a third of that, let's say roughly 3.5 million, are black. That just means that those 3.5 million votes go to whoever they vote for. Right. And the remaining 7 million votes or 7.5 million votes, they go to whoever they vote for, too. I recognize the reality that black people overwhelmingly vote for the Democratic candidate. So I don't want to gloss over that. But not every black person votes for that. And what this means is every individual voter would their votes would count for that candidate.
And the same would apply to, say, on the other side of the coin, conservative voters in California, whose votes also kind of have, have the same situation as black voters in a North Carolina.
Precisely. And you can think about this for like any group, but like Republicans got more votes in California, I believe, than they got anywhere in the country. It might have been Texas, but I'm pretty sure California gave them the most votes. That's a huge number, but they meant nothing because of the Electoral College, right? There were just that many
Wow.
more Democratic votes.
You also use this phrase, the tyranny of the minority. And I wonder, and you use it kind of in response to that argument about politicians disregarding a swath of the country's voters. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I think that is playing out in many ways. I think the Electoral College highlights it very, very pointedly. But we have two presidents in the last couple of the decades that were elected or took office despite not winning
The
a popular
popular
vote,
vote, yeah.
right? And so that starts out, that's a minority win,
Yeah.
right?
Donald
And
Trump,
then what that means,
George W.
yeah,
Bush.
Donald Trump, George W. Bush, and then you just look at the cascading effects of that. You get Donald Trump, who wasn't elected, and he gets to choose three Supreme Court justices who will be there.
Yes.
And you get George W. Bush, who was not elected by the popular vote, and he gets to choose two of his own. So that's five. That's the game, right? And so we think about how the Electoral College, which allows a minority to determine the government, like that's just a start. Tyranny of the majority is bad. I'm not a fan of a democracy where everybody's rights are voted on all the time, and whoever has the most votes in that system gets to say, right? Because that's, I'm a minority. I don't want people just saying, oh, well, you know, if you are a certain person, you don't get these rights, right? Mm-hmm. That's a tyranny of the majority. Mm-hmm. But there is something that is at least a little bit, sits with you a little bit more by saying fundamental decisions about the country and how it's going to be governed is going to be made by the majority of the country. You know, we don't want to go overboard with the tyranny of the majority, but at the same time, we don't want to be governed by a minority, because to me, that's a throwback to what was going on back in the 1700s, right? Yeah. Where we had a few white men governing this country and creating systems that perpetuate that sort of governance, e.g. the Electoral College.
Get into the political reality of changing the Electoral College. Is there an appetite or an incentive from either party to see a different system in place?
I think so. I think most Democrats would support this. In general, if you think about the thrust of policies around elections and democracy in general from the Democratic Party, they tend to say, like, we want to count all people's votes, right? They try to have the Freedom to Vote Act. They want to restore the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah.
I think that there are Republicans who also feel this way. 60% or more than 60% of the country wants this. And more than 60% of the country is not Democrat. So that has to tell you how at least people feel. I do think Republican officials are a bit short-sighted. And now this kind of brings back to my point about looking at how the Electoral College has functioned most recently. And so most recently, because the last times you look at it, it's benefited Republicans. I think they kind of think about it as that, as opposed to thinking about it like, well, how would we think about campaigning under a system where a popular vote chose the president, right? Like, you can change the way you would campaign. And in fact, you would. Right. Like, that goes back to the point I said, I would, if I was a Republican, I'd go to California under a popular vote system, because that's where I won the most Republican votes. And I'm sure that there are Republicans who are not voting because they think their vote is worthless anyway. So there's more to be dug up there. And you know how I can make that statement with pretty much certainty? Because we can look at the turnout in elections in swing states. It's invariably higher than it is in other states. Why is that? It's because they know that their vote matters.
Yes. Huh.
So politically, I think it's difficult. I think it has a large amount of support. Polls show it has support from the people generally. I think one party is totally down with it. I think some leaders in the other party are probably down with it. But, the status quo is it's a real thing.
What can you or I or the person listening do as individuals to affect some type of shift here if we feel so moved?
In terms of everyday people, most people are not con law scholars. They're not like election law scholars. They don't think about this. But I do think they think about having a government that they want and that will be responsive to them. I think that is pretty common. Mm-hmm. And so that just involves getting engaged. The way we got change in the past was just popular investment, popular sort of engagement on these issues. Because in the end, politicians are scared to lose office. And so I think it's really about getting engaged in any way you can, and using the sorts of strengths and influence that you have to make sure that this issue stays top of mind for the people who can actually make the constitutional changes.
Professor Wilfred Codrington III is a constitutional law scholar at the Brooklyn Law School. Professor Codrington, thank you so much.
Aaron, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This conversation is a part of our Democracy Solutions Project. WBEZ, the Chicago Sun-Times, and the Center for Effective Government at the University of Chicago are looking at the critical issues facing our democracy as we approach the November election. You can find more stories like this at wbez.org/democracy. And that's it for today. Justin Bull, Sarah Stark, and I produce The Rundown. Ariel Van Cleve edits the show, and she's our executive producer. Our theme music is by Louis Weeks. The Rundown is produced by WBEZ Chicago, and it's a part of the NPR network. Have you shared this podcast with your friends yet? If you know somebody that's really into all this democracy stuff, go ahead, hit the share button, send it to them. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening to the show. I'll talk to you tomorrow.